were just listening to the opening selections from the ballet Aladdin by my guest, Sean O'Boyle, who conducted the Queensland Orchestra. Well, good morning. It is 2 minutes after 9 on Wednesday, the 8th of August, and you are tuned to WPRB Princeton, New Jersey. Community-supported independent radio at 103.3 FM or online around the world at www.wprb.com. Welcome to another edition of Classical Discoveries. I am your host, Marvin Rosen, and I'm with you for this program every Wednesday between 5:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. I do switch gears at about 11 o'clock with more modern and electronic works on Classical Discoveries Goes Avant-Garde. Thank you so much for joining me today. Well, today on Classical Discoveries, we are taking a trip to Australia and are listening to 7.5 hours of music by Australian composers in a program titled Classical Discoveries Goes Outback, Australia Revisited. Up until 9 o'clock today, I am being joined by Australian composer and conductor Sean O'Boyle. Sean, welcome back.
Thank you so much.
It's great to have you here. And, well, we are going to go back to you, of course, and we'll be talking a tremendous amount about your music. But before we do that, I'd like to welcome for a quick visit, I'd like to welcome his wife, Suzanne Compass, soprano. And now Suzanne is a versatile performer whose talent encompasses all genres of music with equal facility, whether opera, operetta, art song, or the classics of Broadway. She has participated as guest soloists in several music festivals, including the Spoleto Festival of Charleston, South Carolina, and so many more. She has performed with the New York Philharmonic, Los Angeles Philharmonic, Westminster Festival Orchestra, and has worked with such conductors as Zubin Mehta, Carlo Maria Giulini, Robert Shaw, Eric Kunzel, Joseph Flummerfelt, Giancarlo Menotti, Riccardo Muti, and Daniel Barenboim. And while Suzanne Compass is here in Princeton, she and her husband, Sean, are here in Princeton celebrating their second anniversary, which was yesterday. And Suzanne, you do have a local connection to Princeton. Why don't you share a little bit of that?
Hi, Marvin. Thank you so much. First, I have to say for having us here today. Princeton is very close to my heart. As introduction, you mentioned Westminster Choir College or the Westminster connection. I did go to Westminster Choir College and was a member of Westminster Choir, and just absolutely cannot even begin to describe how important and the foundation that laid for my life. So yes, indeed, it is very near and dear and special for me to be back here in Princeton.
And indeed you are. And since it is your second anniversary, who would like to take over and explain how you two met? Sean?
I'll let Sean do that.
Sean, go ahead.
He's blushing, but I'll move the microphone.
I went to Canada to conduct a concert in Toronto, and there was a few parts that had some high notes, so this soprano was hired to sing it, and her name was Suzanne Compass.
And then she's sitting right next to me.
And now she's sitting next to me. And I was 45 minutes late to the rehearsal because the concierge told me the rehearsal venue was 10 minutes away, and in fact it was about an hour or more away from where I was staying. So I walked in late to the rehearsal, but everyone, true to form, was in the middle of, you know, having a look at the music and rehearsing, and I heard this glorious voice, and I looked over, and there was Suzanne, and then she spent the next week hiding from me. But eventually I wore her down, and she moved to Australia, and 2 years and 1 day ago, we got married. And she is the most fabulous soprano on the face of the planet.
Well, that's wonderful. That's wonderful to hear. Now, Suzanne, did you hide from him purposely? I mean, that's quite a loaded comment.
Well, I have to say, we had heard about this esteemed, esteemed Australian conductor coming. I was looking around and, you know, here this very, very down-to-earth, humble, charming man jumped on the podium. And I was just instantly taken with the complete naturalness and purity of his music. conducting, everything. I was just I have a tendency when I'm very taken with something to be a bit shy, not professionally, but to describe my feelings. And so, I didn't quite know what to say to him, and I also didn't want to appear like the soprano who was trying to cozy up to the conductor. You know?
I hear you.
You know, I didn't want him to think I wanted more work or anything like that. I really wanted him to realize how genuine.
He's smiling too next to me.
So eventually we ended up at a pub where a lot of us were having a post-rehearsal beverage. And
I must butt in here. It's whenever we go to a pub, I'm the invisible man. No one ever serves me. So then the next part of the story happens.
Well, of course, he was the maestro, so I made sure that he had a lovely pint of Creemore Springs, anyway. But that's the story. And so I have to say, you know, working with many luminary conductors and singing in many countries and whatnot, I was just very taken with Sean because, first of all, he is so humble. He didn't have a biog. And I remember trying to say, well, you know, you're back in Toronto, and if there's anybody I can introduce you to. And long story short, after a week, he finally let me know. Oh, as I was driving him to the airport, he was asking me what passport he thought he should use, because at that time he's Irish with an name like O'Boyle and an Australian passport. And I said, well, you know, the Olympics, the Americans love the Olympics in Sydney. I think you should use the Australian passport. He said, with a twinkle in his lovely Irish eye, said, I wrote the theme for the Australian Sydney Olympics. I went, oh dear. So that was 2007,
oh,
and thanks to the
gosh.
Glory of Skype, very shyly I became, he would send me more music, and I don't know, it was an instant thing, and here we are today.
Wow. Well, let's talk for a moment before we get to more music, a recent composition which features your voice in it, Suzanne. Before we go to that, though, being objective, I don't know if that's possible, but being objective in working on Sean's music, did you ever have a really severe disagreement about how to perform something?
Honestly, no.
And I had a feeling you were going to say that.
And in fact, I don't think people, I oftentimes preface when I'm speaking about Sean, the fact that I think when you're in a relationship, if anything, the truth is paramount. And you know, the way Sean looks after me, or will be honest with me about repertoire or choices that we make in our careers, you know, there's absolutely that. Again, there was the like-mindedness of how we think. I mean, we did the opening movement of the movement, the Kyrie in the. Requiem. Sean actually had written a bit more spirited version. And one thing that I have done my entire life, because my singing started in the church, being a choral person, of course, Westminster Choir College, I always maintained a soloist position. And I was very fortunate in Toronto to actually be a cantor in a fabulous Catholic church. And, of course, steeped in singing many requiems. So we did actually, what would you say?
I had a discussion.
She made me rewrite it three times.
Oh, now we're coming.
I thought it should have a little bit more of a
spiritual.
You'll hear it. Well, actually, it was just more sort of a plain chanter.
Yeah.
You know, more of a chanting thing.
And that was really, Suzanne and Sean, that was a really great segue to our next discussion, which is about the Requiem, and we're going to hear the opening four sections of it. Sean, tell us about how it came into being.
The Requiem came into being with the Glenridge Choral Society in Glenridge, New Jersey, and a Westminster connection of the music director Tom Mustachio. Suzanne had sung a Stabat Mater, a Rossini, the year before, and I said to Tom, I really would like to write a Requiem or something, because I like the choir and I like the way they had a little orchestra and the way they did things. So in our exile in Canada, I thought, what better way to spend my time is to spend a few weeks and write the Requiem. And the Kyrie is true. I wrote a really fun, robust Kyrie, and Suzanne encouraged me to relook at that. And so we have quite a different Kyrie now. In fact, the third. I think it is the third Kyrie. So Tom said agreed to perform it with his with the Glenridge Choral Society. Suzanne sang the soprano part, more Westminster connections with Lisa Remdy as the mezzo-soprano and Glenn Boothby as the bass baritone. And a neighbour and friend of ours in New York, John Pickle, was the tenor soloist. So we had our soloists and we had a little orchestra. My very dear friend Graham Ashton, who is a British trumpeter but now lives in Westchester County, who's played with the London Symphony and every major orchestra in Europe, he came down and played for us. So it was really fun thing to do. So we only took an archival recording, but you'll get the sense of the live.
Sure. And we'll be listening to the first four sections of the work. This is the Requiem by my guest, Sean O'Boyle. You were just listening to the opening four sections of The Requiem by my guest, Sean O'Boyle. And Sean, who were our artists?
Suzanne Compass, my wife, soprano, yeah. Lisa Remdy, the mezzo-soprano, John Pickle, tenor, and Glenn Boothby, bass baritone. Three Westminster alumni amongst those.
And it was with which choir?
The Glenridge Choral Society. And their music director, I conducted the performance because I wrote quite a challenging organ part that their music director had to play, because originally we were going to have him just direct it from the organ, but it was problematic.
Yeah, so you did the conducting. Very, very good. Well, Sean, let's go now, speaking of your work as a conductor, let's go to that. In your work, you'd present music from all periods. Is there any specific thing you specialize in, or...?
No, if it's good and I like it, and or an orchestra engages me to conduct something, I'm there. It could be anything. I mean, we have such a rich history of music, and it's just, you know, fabulous to delve back 300 or 400 years, or 300 or 400 minutes, depending on who's written what.
Yes, I like the 300 or 400 minutes, but going back, that I like. Now let's go to contemporary Australian composers a little bit. Now the music of Australia is indeed very exciting, and I think that's so little of it, and it's very sad. There is really so little of it that is known here. I mean, you mentioned people like Peter Sculthorpe and Percy Grainger, Arthur Benjamin, but Percy Grainger, we all know, lived much of his life here in the U.S. Why do you feel, Sean, that Australian composers are not generally well known here? The music's wonderful.
I think it's pretty much the same as many countries that, you know, there are a lot of composers and very little resources. So you stay in your own country and you make a name for yourself and you have your orchestras play it. It's the same here in the US.
Sure.
There are so many composers here that my contemporaries and even the listening audience in Australia would never have heard of. You know, incredible composers. So we tend to be a little bit parochial, I guess. So we thought we'd come to America, and as Percy Grainger did.
Yeah.
And he's well-loved. He's well-loved here.
Well, let's go now, keeping with Australian music, because, I mean, there are so many composers, so much talent, and so much music, which is very, I hate using the word, but music which is accessible to audiences being written over there. But when you listen to Australian music, Sean, do you feel that there is a special sound or character?
I'm not sure if there's a special sound or character. The ancient Australians only played, some of them played the didgeridoo, and there's a few other instruments. And so that's kind of the unique Australian sound, and people have heard it in movies, and you know they recognize those sounds. But to have an actual Australian orchestral sound, maybe Peter Sculthorpe's come the closest, and Ross Edwards.
Ross Edwards,
definitely. Australia is a place of great beauty, both beautiful and yet terrible. On the outskirts from tropical north, there's the Great Barrier Reef, and there's this whole incredible tropical area, and it's really beautiful, down to some mountains, the Great Dividing Range, which go all the way down to the bottom on the east coast. And then Tasmania is its own beautiful place, an island two or three times the size of England, with a population of about 400,000 people. So you have this massive areas with a very small population. And the desert, Australia is largely desert because we don't have very many mountain ranges. So you get out into what we call the outback, and it is a terrible beauty because it is a brutal place to try and live, yet people do. So the sense of this enormous landscape is in a lot of people's compositions, and the diverse range of, you know, you can be diving on beautiful tropical reefs, and then a two-hour drive, you're in the middle of the desert.
Yeah, and also, you know, I notice in listening to music by Australian composers, you find the inspiration, because it's not that far of, like, some of the countries like Indonesia and some of the Pacific, you know, some of the other countries out there where you have some of these very more exotic
Yeah, and there was an era where there's, you know, there was a lot of like gamelan and all sorts sorts of things happening in Australian music because Indonesia and you know those places are just there.
It's there. Well, there's a real rich diversity in the music of Australian composers. And how about you, Sean? How has Australia, do you feel, inspired your work?
Well, I feel that I'm very Celtic. My grandfather was a Celtic fiddler and a carpenter. And so he would have his day job, and then at night he'd go and play for dancers, and, you know, he's played his fiddle everywhere. And so I have that in my blood. We played the Celtic dance.
Yeah, sure, sure.
At the start of it. So I'm kind of... A lot of the things I write always sound a little bit Celtic to me, but I guess, you know, there's a fair bit of Australian, if there is a sound of Australia, it's that, you know, it's the big wide open spaces. But the country and the people, you know, really influence you. It's such a diverse, as America is, it's such a diverse country and of people from all walks of life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very interesting. Well, now, Sean, I'd like to go to incredible work of yours. We are going to go to your concerto for didgeridoo and orchestra. First of all, for the uninitiated, what is a didgeridoo? How would you describe it to people who are not familiar with it?
A didgeridoo is a hollow branch from a tree. And that's basically...
That was simple.
That's simple. And so there's no particular lengths. It's just depending how it sounds. Most, you would go up to a tree and tap it to see if it was hollow from termites. And then it's shaped by fire to get rid of the termites and to make it the bore more smooth. And it generally has a flared end, and the other end is more like maybe a tuba mouthpiece, and the players put beeswax around it to shape it so that it's comfortable to play. And playing with orchestras, you know, the didgeridoos actually come in keys, like for the drone note. So, you know, you can have a B flat, A, C, whatever. So the didgeridoo concerto starts off with the drone note as E flat, because when William Barton, our didgeridooist, came to my studio, he didn't bring a didgeridoo, but I had one in the corner that was pitched in E flat. So that's kind of where we started.
Mm-hmm. And what was his, I guess, his involvement with this work? I mean, because you look at the back of the cover, his name is there.
Yeah, well, how it happened was when I wrote the theme for the Sydney Olympics, I had to have a didgeridoo player on the track. So William was a young guy then, and I called him and said, would you come and play? So we recorded the orchestral part. He listened to it, and then he did some mimicking and played across the top of it. And he brought such a great musical passion and fantastic ideas that I was really ashamed and embarrassed that I'd made it an afterthought. So I said to William, when we can, let us write together a didgeridoo concerto. So William came to my studio, and he sang some of his themes from... He's from Mount Isa, which is in the middle of nowhere on the Queensland and Northern Territory border, a mining frontier town. And he then... We decided to do it as the elements, earth, wind, water, fire. And he played and I recorded what his ideas through his didgeridoo of those elements were. And then... He had some great rhythmic parts, as you'll hear in it. Mm. So I notated the rhythms, and then I made melodies with the rhythms. Wow. So I used his source material as well as mine, and we made this didgeridoo concerto together. Now, long have our William and others, has the, you know, European type composers come along, used them, got them to play, and never acknowledge their contribution artistically. So I felt it was really important to say we wrote this together.
Very interesting and very, very non-selfish of you also, I have to say. Sean, how about other composers writing for didgeridoo today?
The didgeridoo doesn't have a notation system except for a man here in, I think, in Milwaukee, a guy called Hal Kanacek. And he actually played the US premiere of the Didgeridoo Concerto, and Suzanne and I were lucky enough to be there. And his didgeridoo he made out of PVC piping. And he would slide it to the next key, which was pretty interesting thing. But he invented a notation system for what William had played, because how we recorded it, and then William overdubbed his parts, and we got it right, and spent quite a lot of time composing as we improvised the didgeridoo part, and Hal wrote it out. So in a sense, he invented this language of how to write for didgeridoo.
And I have to say, you know, in listening to works, concertos featuring instruments unique to a country, let's say, I mean, I think if more of that was here in America, this music would bring the house down. I'm thinking of a tar concerto from Azerbaijan and stuff like that. It's so exciting. And I have a feeling your didgeridoo concerto brought the house down.
Yes, it does.
There you go.
It brings the house down. The people, they can hardly believe that this is happening with an orchestra in full flight and, you know, the didgeridoo doing what the didgeridoo does and providing an enormous range of colours. And you were saying about Australian sounds. Yeah. Through the didgeridoo, the drone is made, which is the sound. And then the player, the didgeridoo player, then makes sounds of the Australian animals and bush and rain and like the kookaburras going and barking like dogs
effects.
And you hear that coming all the way through it, and there's all there's a fascinating bird called the brolga, which is about the same size as an ostrich, and it does this incredible dance in the mating season, and the Aboriginal people have created this a sound for the dance. So all those elements are in the concerto.
Unbelievable. And this is a work in four movements?
In four movements.
And tell us who we're going to hear. William Barton will be our didgeridoo.
Yeah, William Barton is our soloist. The Queensland Orchestra, which is now called the Queensland Symphony Orchestra again. It merged, two orchestras merged, and they couldn't decide on a name. But now it's come back to the Queensland Symphony, and I've done a lot of work with that orchestra over many, many years. And naturally, because I seem to premiere all my own works, I'm conducting.
We listen now to the Didgeridoo Concerto by my guest, Sean O'Boyle.
Oh, Ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba.